Okay, I'd like to pick up where we left off in the book of Jeremiah. We left off in chapter 50, but what's interesting about this chapter 50 and chapter 51, both these chapters are dealing with the destruction of Babylon. Now, here's the thing that people have to understand when we're dealing with this destruction of Babylon, you know, predicted by Jeremiah. These two chapters, 50 and 51, they cover, I think, about no less than 110 verses. All right, but it's all dealing with Babylon's destruction. Now, people have to get this, I think, straight in their mind. Babylon has never experienced a violent overthrow the way that Jeremiah and the other prophets have predicted. And when we're reading chapter 50 and we're reading chapter 51, we have to be able to discern, okay, when exactly are certain things that are prophesied happening? Some of them happened in the past. Some of them happened back there in 539 BC when the Medes and the Persians overran Babylon under Cyrus the Great. But then God has predicted a complete destruction of Babylon, a total and complete destruction of this city that is never going to be rebuilt. But here's the thing that people have to understand is that Babylon has never really had this violent overthrow that the prophets have foretold, because, you know, you just follow the history of Babylon. And it was captured by Cyrus. And matter of fact, Cyrus the Great, he was predicted by Isaiah the prophet 125 years before he was even born. God predicted Cyrus by name. We read that in Isaiah chapter 44 and chapter 45. Isaiah made that prophecy something like around 712 BC or something like that. He prophesied that Cyrus would come on the scene. And he overran Babylon in 539 BC. But remember how he did it when we read through Daniel chapter 5, where there was a situation where you had Belshazzar. He was throwing this drunken bash, and he just figured that he was totally secure in spite of the fact that his city, Babylon, was under siege, and it had been under siege for months. And he's throwing this drunken bash, and then he decides, well, you know what, why don't we get all the utensils and all the plates and all the cups and everything out of the stores that belonged to God's temple down there, Solomon's temple down there in Jerusalem. And it wasn't that they were short on cups and plates and utensils or anything like that. You know, this guy was just a blasphemer. He just wanted to blaspheme the God of heaven. So he brings in all these cups, and they're all drinking out of the sacred bowls and whatnot, and they're all praising the gods of gold and silver and stone and brass and wood and all this stuff. They're just carrying on, having this big orgy. And then that was the situation where, in the middle of all this carrying on, the hand just comes out and writes, "Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin." And man, there was just a complete hush over this Babylon, over this party that was happening in Babylon. Anyway, if you recall the story, the king was really, really shaken up about that. He said, we are told in the Bible that his knees started knocking, he got really weak, and then, you know, he called for all of his conjurers, he called for all of his magicians, he called for all of his soothsayers to try to interpret what that meant. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. Nobody could interpret it. But then the king's mother came in and he said, well, there's a man in the kingdom that your father used to refer to, and that was Daniel, and he probably can interpret it. Anyway, Daniel goes into this banquet hall. He interprets that, mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. He says, man, you should have known better to do this than to blaspheme God of heaven with all of this carrying on with these holy vessels. And so what he did is he said that mene, mene, tekel, upharsin meant that your kingdom has been numbered. And the fact that he said it twice, mene, mene, means that it's going to happen immediately. And he says, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. And now your kingdom is going to be divided among the Medes and the Persians. And that night that Belshazzar was killed, and the Persians, the Medes and Persians, took over Babylon. Now, I'm just going through all this because I think it's really, really important that we understand what this Babylon is and what these prophecies are about. When we look at the history of Babylon, like I said, it was overthrown, but it wasn't overthrown in such a violent way that it was just ransacked and burned to the ground, because even 3 days after the Medes and the Persians overtook Babylon, a lot of people didn't even know that it was conquered. And so the Medes and the Persians just took it over, and then Some years later, the city revolted against Darius when he took over. And what happened against that revolt is that he managed to put that down after about a 20-month siege. That was around 516 BC. And then in 531 BC, Alexander the Great came up to the city of Babylon, and he was going to destroy it. But the people just opened up the gates and just welcomed him in. And so Babylon was still standing. And then 293 BC, that's when these Greek kings, or these Seleucid kings, built a capital real close to Babylon, you know, a few miles away. And what it did is it really started drawing away a lot of people from the city of Babylon into this new built city. And then Babylon just went into decline. In 60 AD, the Apostle Peter was there. He was working among the Jews that remained in Babylon. As a matter of fact, that's when he wrote his epistle. In 1 Peter chapter 5, he mentions these Christians over there in Babylon. And then in the 5th century, it was inhabited by Jews. And in 917 AD, it was an insignificant village, but it was still in existence. And then in 1898, it had at least 10,000 inhabitants. And it was reduced to a little village called Hilla at one time. But guess what? Under Saddam Hussein, he basically resurrected the city. Now, granted, they had unearthed a lot of the Babylon, but Babylon never had this violent overthrow that we're going to be reading about tonight and next week. And people feel like, well, this city was buried, and there's no way it's going to be rebuilt. But I've got these pictures all here about how Saddam Hussein has rebuilt this city. Now, this city isn't a massive big city, but this city is going to come back into prominence. It's my strong conviction that it is, because we read all about that in Revelation chapter 18, where this city is going to become the economic metropolis of the world. But keep this in mind. When we read chapter 18 of Revelation, God was talking about this being a great city, but it's not going to be a great city in terms of its size, but it is going to be a great city in terms of its significance. And then God is going to have this city totally and completely destroyed, and then nobody's going to ever hear a peep out of Babylon again. But it's in existence. It's been in existence for centuries, and there's people living in Babylon today. And if you look at all these pictures there, it's been pretty much unearthed and rebuilt in a lot of ways under Saddam Hussein, even though he's been long dead now. Now, I know I've just kind of beat this to death, but when we're reading about this prophecy against Babylon and the other prophets that foretold things about Babylon too, we have to get it straight in our head exactly when this takes place, how it takes place, and that it's really literally Babylon. It's not symbolic. It's not the Catholic Church. It's not some city over there in New York. They got a city over there called Babylon, New York. It's not that city. This is going to be the city that the Bible talks about from one end of this book to the other, from Genesis to Revelation. It talks about this city. All right, beginning with that verse 1 of chapter 50. And Jeremiah says, "The word which the Lord spoke concerning Babylon, the land of the Chaldeans, through the Jeremiah the prophet, declare and proclaim among the nations, proclaim it and lift up a standard. Do not conceal it, but say, Babylon has been captured, Baal has been put to shame, Marduk has been shattered, her images have been put to shame, her idols have been shattered. For a nation has come up against her out of the north. It will make her land an object of horror, and there will be no inhabitants in it." Now, I want to repeat that. It says here, there will be no inhabitant in it. Now, Babylon has always been inhabited. This hasn't been fulfilled yet, right? "Both man and beast have wandered off. They have gone away. In those days, and at that time, declares the Lord, the sons of Israel will come, both they and their sons of Judah as well. They will go along weeping as they go, and it will be the Lord their God they will seek. They will ask for the way to Zion, turning their faces in its direction. They will come that they may join themselves to the Lord in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten." Now, here's what's going on here. When it's talking about a nation in that verse 3, that says a nation has come up against her from the north, well, this is when they were basically attacked by the Medes and the Persians. They were overthrown in 539 B.C. What's that talking about? Is this nation from the north? Now, we have to make the discernment here that it's talking about a near destruction of Babylon and then a destruction, a total and complete annihilation of Babylon at the end of the world. But when we're reading that, like that verse 5 is talking about the Jews here, it says, "They will ask for the way to Zion, turning their faces in its direction, they will come, that they may join themselves to the Lord in an everlasting covenant that will not be forgotten. And this is going to be at the end days, because it's at the very end of the world that Babylon is going to be destroyed. As a matter of fact, it's my belief, it's my contention of trying to put everything together. I'm making an educated guess here, but it's my opinion that Babylon itself, when it becomes the economic trade center of the world, it's going to be destroyed with a nuclear blast, and it's going to be destroyed 30 days, about a month before the total end of the world. And as a matter of fact, I believe that it's going to be the destruction of this Babylon that's described in Revelation chapter 18. I believe that it's going to be that destruction where I think that the world is going to look to the Jews as a scapegoat, and they're going to say that the Jews are responsible for this, and that's going to really kick off the final battle of the world, which was going to be the Battle of Armageddon. Now, I know I'm all over the map here, but man, we have to put this together. This really, really gets involved. And that verse 6 here, it says, "My people have become lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray. They have made them turn aside on the mountains. They have gone along from mountain to hill, and they have forgotten their resting place." Now, that verse 6, that's referring to the time before the destruction of Babylon. This is when the Babylonians came down and destroyed Jerusalem. And verse 7 says, "All who came upon them have devoured them, and their adversaries have said, 'We are not guilty,' inasmuch as they have sinned against the Lord, who is the habitation of righteousness, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers. Wander away from the midst of Babylon, and go forth from the land of the Chaldeans. Be also like a male goat at the head of the flock. For behold, I am going to arouse and bring up against Babylon a horde of great nations from the land of the north, and they will draw up their battle lines against her. From there she will be taken captive. Their arrows will be like an expert warrior who does not return empty-handed." Now remember, we read all about this when we read about in different portions of the Bible where it talked about the overthrow of Babylon by the Medes and the Persians. But remember, it was Cyrus. He was the one that was predicted that would come upon the scene, and he was the one that God used to overthrow the Babylonian kingdom. But it was through Cyrus that he issued that decree that the Jews could then return to their promised land. He issued that decree, and then under Ezra and under Nehemiah, they had different waves of the Jews going back to Jerusalem, going back to Israel, because of this man that God had predicted would come upon the scene, you know, over a century before he was even born. And then you look at this verse 10, "Chaldea will become plunder. All who plunder her will have enough, declares the Lord. Because you are glad, because you are the jubilant, O you who pillage my heritage, because you skip about like a threshing heifer and neigh like stallions. Your mother will be greatly ashamed. She who gave you birth will be humiliated. Behold, she will be the least of the nations, a wilderness, a parched land, and a desert." Well, that's what the way the Babylonians felt about the Jews when they overthrew them under Nebuchadnezzar. But this is going to have its ultimate fulfillment too. Because you can see clearly how the Jews are just despised and they are just hated by virtually every nation on earth. And don't forget this, Babylon is in Iraq. It's in the heart of Iraq, right there by the Euphrates River. And the people of Iraq, the people of Iran, all of these other nations, a lot of them are Muslims. At the very end, they're going to absolutely hold Israel in contempt. You can see that right now today. But God has a special judgment for this particular city because of what she represents. He says in that verse 13, "Because of the indignation of the Lord, she will not be inhabited, but she will be completely desolate." Now, look at that. I want to read that again, because this is the second time this has said this. "Because of the indignation of the Lord, she will not be inhabited." Well, I just showed you here how Babylon has always been inhabited, even though she's been overthrown, even though she's become desolate in many, many ways. She's always been inhabited, even when she was reduced to just nothing more than a village. And he says here, "But she will be completely desolate." That hasn't happened yet. "Everyone who passes by Babylon will be horrified and will hiss because of all of her wounds. Draw up battle lines against Babylon on every side. All you who bend a bow, shoot at her. Do not be sparing with your arrows, for she has sinned against the Lord." Now this is applying, I think, primarily to, you know, the Medes and the Persians when they overthrew her way back then in 539 BC. It says, "Raise your battle cry against her on every side. She has given herself up. Her pillars have fallen. Her walls have been torn down. For this is the vengeance of the Lord. Take vengeance on her as she has done to others, so do to her. Cut off the sower from Babylon and the one who wields the sickle at the time of harvest. From before the sword of the oppressor, they will each turn back to his own people, and they will each flee to his own land. Israel is a scattered flock. The lions have driven them away. The first one who devoured him was the king of Assyria, and his last one who has broken his bones is Nebuchadnezzar, of king of Babylon. So you see a situation here where you could see that God doesn't change. I mean, he always deals with his people first. I mean, those people who claim to be his people, the judgment will always begin with them. And we read all about it through Kings, through Chronicles, through other portions of Scripture, how God brought the Assyrians down to destroy the northern tribes of Israel when they really got away from God. They really got steeped up to their eyeballs in idolatry and immorality and godlessness and all kinds of heathen practices and worship and this type of thing. And then God just destroyed the northern kingdom and had the survivors hauled off. And then over 100 years later, he destroyed the southern kingdom with Nebuchadnezzar. And I'm telling you right now, I mean, we could just look at history. At least I do. I look at history and I see the history just keeps repeating itself. I mean, it just does. And I can see clearly that what happened to these nations that God has judged, you know, when we read, you know, all about these other nations like Moab and Ammon and Edom and Elam, all these other nations that God pronounced judgments on. Well, this nation's not going to escape. Because our iniquity is just overflowing. It just is. And we're not going to escape the judgment either. But then he says here in that verse 18, he says, "Therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I am going to punish the king of Babylon in his land, just as I punished the king of Assyria." See what I mean? God used the Assyrians to chastise his people. And then God turned around and used the Babylonians to do a number on the Assyrians. But now God is going to punish the Babylonians. You see what I'm saying? He's no respecter of persons. This cup of his judgment is just going to be passed from nation to nation. You better believe it's going to happen right before the end of the world as well. And he says in verse 19, he says, "I will bring Israel back to his pasture, and he will graze on Carmel and Bashan, and his desire will be satisfied in the hill country of Ephraim and Gilead." Now, this had its beginning. It had its beginning fulfillment under Cyrus when he allowed the people to go back to their homeland. But then what happened? They got back to their homeland. They were there till Jesus Christ came along, and then they rejected the Messiah. And then under the Romans, under the Roman commander Titus, they were thrown out of the land again in 70 AD. And the prophets all predicted they would come back again. And sure enough, they have. So this has a near fulfillment, and that had already been in the past, but it also has the fulfillment we can see in our own day, them becoming a nation again. And at verse 20, it says, "In those days, and at that time, declares the Lord, search will be made for the iniquity of Israel, but there will be none, and for the sins of Judah, but they will not be found, for I will pardon those whom I leave as a remnant." Now, what day would this be? Look at the context. Look at that verse 20. "In those days, and at that time, declares the Lord, search will be made for the iniquity of Israel, and there will be none." Well, that isn't today. It's never been any time in the past. Why? Why do I say that?
Because they still have sin.
Yeah. Israel is up to their eyeballs in all kinds of iniquity today. They just are. So this is going to have its fulfillment when Jesus Christ literally, physically returns to the earth. And the remnant of the Jews that are going to turn to him when they see him coming back. All right. That's the ones he's going to cleanse of all unrighteousness. They're going to commit themselves to Jesus Christ and they're never going to be unfaithful again. You see how the prophets do this? All of them do this. The minor prophets, major prophets, you can see this. They make a very near prophecy in regards to the future, and then very far-reaching prophecies. And I think we just have to have the discernment to see which prophecies come first. Because this prophecy in that verse 20, this has never happened yet. It's obvious to me because they're just as sinful today as they have been many times in their own past. And then look at that verse 21. "Against the land of Merathaim, go up against it, and against the inhabitants of Pekod, slay and utterly destroy them, declares the Lord, and do according to all that I have commanded you." Now, this is kind of a play on words, because Merathaim, it literally means double rebellion. So he's talking about Babylon here as being a city of double rebellion. But when we get into the Revelation, especially 17 and 18, we're going to find that he's talking about both a religious rebellion and a political rebellion against God. And that's what he's talking about here in that verse 21 where he says, Marathaim, and also that Pekah, it means punishment. It says against the inhabitants of punishment. God has a special judgment coming against them. And that verse 22, the noise of battle is in the land and great destruction. How the hammer of the whole earth has been cut off and broken. How Babylon has become an object of horror among the nations. Well, that's what happened back there when they were broken by the Medes and the Persians. But they still survived, you know, for centuries. And it says in verse 24, I set a snare for you, and you were also caught, O Babylon, while you yourself were not aware. You have been found and also seized because you have engaged in a conflict with the Lord. See, this is the thing. You know, I don't care what nation it is, but it talks about Babylon being in conflict with the Lord. They're in conflict with the Lord, but you could see it. You could see it the night that they were overthrown by the Medes and the Persians. You could see this kind of arrogance, this kind of blasphemy that these people had against the God of heaven. It was just epitomized in this Belshazzar when he threw this drunken feast and just went out of his way to insult the God of heaven, didn't he? You know, he just went out of his way. And I'm telling you right now, this country is going out of its way to insult God. Look around, open your eyes, and look. Everywhere you turn, God is being insulted, he's being marginalized, he's being ostracized, he's being driven out from one place to another, he's been kicked out of our schools and our educational system and our judicial system, out of our government. Just look around you and see how God is being basically insulted today, and so is his people, and so is the Bible. And in verse 25 it says, the Lord has opened his armory, he has brought forth the weapons of his indignation, for it is a work of the Lord God of hosts in the land of the Chaldeans. And in other words, God is the one that's going to do this to them. They're going to be destroyed by other nations, but it's God, he's the one that's orchestrating it. And verse 26, come to her from the farthest border, open up her barns, pile her up like heaps, and utterly destroy her. Let nothing be left to her. Now, I want to read this again, all right? Because this hasn't been completely fulfilled yet. Open up her barns, pile her up like heaps, and utterly destroy her. Let nothing be left to her. Well, that has never happened yet. In verse 27, it says, put all her young bulls to the sword. Let them go down to the slaughter. Woe be upon them, for their day has come, the time of their punishment. Now, this verse 27, this had its fulfillment back in 539, when Cyrus overthrew the Babylon, right? You see how this vacillates back and forth, near judgment, far judgment, near judgment, far judgment, and we just have to have the discernment to put it all together of when it took place and when it's going to take place. In verse 28, there is a sound of fugitives and refugees from the land of Babylon to declare in Zion the vengeance of the Lord our God, vengeance for his temple. Like I said, this has had a past fulfillment, because it was the Jews that escaped from Babylon that went back and rebuilt their temple there. This isn't future date, this is past date. But like I said, it always goes back and forth. And in verse 29 it says, summon many against Babylon, all those who bend the bow, encamp against her on every side. Let there be no escape. Repay her according to her work, according to all that she has done. So do to her, for she has become arrogant against the Lord, against the Holy One of Israel. Now this had its fulfillment, you know, under the Medes and the Persians. But look at why God is judging her. Because she become arrogant against the Lord, against the Holy One of Israel. Now has this nation become arrogant against God? I mean, you know, just go pick up tomorrow's paper and you could see it. You could see just the way that God is just insulted 24/7 around this nation. And, you know, we're not going to get away with it any more than they got away with it. In that verse 30, it says, therefore, her young men will fall in her streets, and all her men of war will be silenced in that day, declares the Lord. And that happened under 539 BC. Behold, I am against you, O arrogant one, declares the Lord God of hosts, for your day has come, the time when I will punish you. The arrogant one will stumble and fall with no one to raise him up, and I will set fire to his cities, and it will devour all its environs. Now, this hasn't happened yet totally and completely, because we read about that in chapter 18 of Revelation, where God is going to destroy this city with fire. It's going to go up in smoke, and her destruction, it says in Revelation chapter 18, it's going to happen in 1 hour, in 1 hour, in 1 hour. It just keeps repeating that in Revelations in regards to destruction of this city. And verse 33 says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the sons of Israel are oppressed, and all the sons of Judah are as well. and all who took them captive had held them fast. They have refused to let them go. Their Redeemer is strong. The Lord of hosts is his name. He will vigorously plead their case so that he may bring rest to the earth, but turmoil to the inhabitants of Babylon. Of course, that happened when God, after the 70 years were up, after he chastised his people and they were in exile in Babylon, then God opened the door for them to return back to their homeland after Babylon was overthrown in terms of being a world power. And in verse 35 it says, "A sword against the Chaldeans, declares the Lord, and against the inhabitants of Babylon, and against her officials and her wise men." That's what happened. Remember 539 B.C. when Belshazzar had that feast and his kingdom was overthrown that night. In verse 36, "A sword against the oracle priest, and they will become fools. A sword against the mighty men, and they will be shattered." Remember the handwriting on the wall? The priest and the magicians and the wise men. Nobody could figure it out. And then, God just broke their army in half. And it was interesting how they ended up doing it, too, because they ended up damming up the fords to the river, to the Euphrates River. And because they dammed it up, that water that ran underneath the city and filled that moat around the city, it dried up. And they just walked underneath the muddy foundations underneath the city because the water had dried up. And then they had other people, who bribed people to open up the gates, to open up the doors. That's how they overthrew that city. And verse 37 says, "A sword against her horses, against her chariots, against all the foreigners who are in the midst of her, and they will become women. A sword against her treasures, and they will be plundered." Well, that's what happened to her in the past. And in verse 38 says, "A drought on her waters, and they will be dried up, for it is a land of idols, and they are mad over fearsome idols." Now here's the thing, when we went through Revelation chapter 17, Babylon is referred to as the mother of harlots. Alright, now here's something we have to understand. It was in Babylon where all different types of idolatry and pagan worship began. As a matter of fact, in chapter 10 of Genesis, we read about this guy named Nimrod. He was the one that founded Babylon. It says this. This is the first mention of Babylon in the Bible, and that's back there in chapter 10. It says this. It says, "Now Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calneth, in the land of Shinar." Now, the land of Shinar is what? What's Shinar?
Babylon.
It's the ancient name for Babylon. You know, that's the first mention of Babylon here. And we read about what happened there. There was a guy named Nimrod. And who could tell me what this means? It says this, "He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said," quote, "like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord," unquote. What does that mean? Well, here's my take on it. You could see this throughout all kinds of people throughout history, where if you had a guy who was really a mighty hunter or a mighty warrior, he usually became chief. He usually became the head of the clan, the head of the tribe, all right, the head of the nation. You know what I'm saying? This Nimrod was actually the first world leader. All right, because it says here, "He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord." In other words, he was the one who could galvanize the people on the earth at that particular time into one, basically nation. Right? But God, if we read the book of Genesis, we discover that God was trying to get the people to spread out over the land, over the earth. But Nimrod was basically saying, no, don't spread out. And then eventually they ended up building that tower of Babel. And that's when God went down and confounded their language. And then they were forced to spread out. But it's interesting. That's where it all began, back there in the land of Shinar. Now, what's interesting too is that the prophet Zechariah mentions this Babylon. Now, there's two parts to this Babylon. One is a religious whore and one is an economic whore. Because in Zechariah, we went through that. It says this. This was a prediction about Babylon. It says, "Then the angel who was speaking with me went out and said to me, 'Lift up now your eyes and see what is going forth.' And I said, 'What is it?' And he said, 'This is the Ephah going forth.' And he said, 'This is their appearance in all the land, and behold, a lead cover was lifted up, and this is a woman sitting inside the ephah. And he said, this is wickedness. And he threw her down in the middle of the ephah and cast the lead weight on its opening. Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and there were two women coming out with the wind in their wings, and they had wings like the wings of a stork, and they lifted up the ephah between earth and heaven. And I said to the angel who was speaking to me, where are they taking the ephah? And he said to me, to build a temple for her and the land of Shinar, and when it is prepared, she will be set there on her own pedestal. Now, he's talking about this. If you read this account, this woman represents commerce, money, material things, wealth, riches, this type of thing. Well, at the very end, towards the very end of the world, she's going to have a temple built for her back in the land of Shinar. That's why I keep telling people that Babylon is going to come back into prominence, and she is going to become an economic trade power of the world. In other words, what I'm saying is she's going to be the center of the world economic system. Because we read that in Revelation chapter 18, it says this, after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory, and he cried out with a mighty voice saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the great. She has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. Now, I don't have time to really get into this, but here's the thing. This is a two-sided coin. This is twofold in terms of the idolatry that is involved here. In chapter 17, it dealt with a religious whore. It dealt with a religious whore that encompassed all the false teachings, all the cults, all the false religious systems, everything that claims to be spiritual that is opposed to God and is opposed to Jesus Christ and His Word, that is epitomized in the whore of Babylon that's going to be destroyed, and in my opinion, around mid-trib. But this other whore is the other side of the coin. It is an economic whore. And it says right here, all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. Well, what's the immorality that he's talking about here?
The love of money.
It's the love of money. And Jesus Christ said, hey man, nobody can serve two masters. You're either going to love one or hate the other, cleave to one or despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Well, here's what all the nations of the world, all right, you can find people who have basically compromised their commitment to God because of the love of money. So God has a special judgment for this whore. He's going to judge the religious whore, in my opinion, 3.5 years into the tribulation period. And he's going to judge this economic whore about 30 days before the end of the world. And it goes on to say, in regards to this Babylon, he says, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive of her plagues. For her sins have piled as high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her. To the degree that she has glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, and I am not a widow, and will never see mourning. For this reason in one day, now I'm going to repeat that, for this reason in one day her plagues will come, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong. All right? This is going to be a total destruction of the city. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. Like I said, this city is going to come back into prominence, but don't get this picture that's going to be a big, massive metropolis like New York or LA or San Francisco, but it's going to be great in terms of its significance, in terms of its importance, its global importance. It's going to become the nerve center of the wealth of the world. And it says, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys her cargo anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from every very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives, the fruit that you long for has gone from you, and all the things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning and saying, woe, woe, the great city, she who was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and silver and precious pearls, and for in 1 hour such great wealth has been laid waste, and in every shipmaster and every passerby and sailor, and as many as made their living by the sea, stood at a distance, and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like the great city? For they threw dust on their heads, and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city, which is in which all who have ships at sea became rich by the wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste. You see, three times I've read here that this city is going to be destroyed in 1 hour, and she's going to be destroyed with fire. This has never happened before. And then it goes on to just simply say, for the saints to rejoice over her destruction because of so much of the wickedness that she has perpetrated upon the world because of the love of money. You see, I'm saying this whore that God is talking about is a two-sided whore. One's religious and one's political. But that religious whore, don't think for 1 minute that it just people should just say, well, it's the Catholic Church, and just blow it off like that. No, this religious whore encompasses everything that is opposed to the knowledge of God. Every single cult, every form of spiritualism, everything. It had its birth back there in Babylon. Both the economic whore and the religious whore had its birth back there. It was back there in Babylon that people went from basically a barter system, or people went from living off the land to then producing a currency. And that's where it all started, and it's going to have its ending there as well, because people have put money before God. They have prostituted their relationship with God constantly, continuously, because of the love of money. Now, I know I've been all over the map here, but man, we are really biting off more than I could chew, to tell you the truth, when we're dealing with this Babylon. And there's 110 verses just dealing with it, and they broke it up into two chapters, and we're just going to wind this chapter down. But I wanted people to get an overview of where this is coming from, what it's talking about. All right? Let's pick up with that verse 37 back in Jeremiah chapter 50. It says, a sword against their horses and against their chariots, against all the foreigners who are in the midst of her, and they will become women. A sword against her treasures, and they will become plundered. Well, that's what happened under Cyrus. It says, a drought on her waters, and they will be dried up, for it is a land of idols, and they are mad over fearsome idols. You see what I'm saying? That Babylon, it was the mother of harlots. She became what? A land of idols. They're mad over fearsome idols. In other words, you know, when people put things before God, they put idols in the place of God. And I don't care. It could be your stinking piggy bank. Guess what? You end up going mad in this respect. You lose all sense of perspective of what's really happening. Look at this country. It's got all kinds of problems. It's got problems innumerable. There's no solving our problems. But look at all of our politicians. All right? They're coming up with one stupid, idiotic, foolish thing after another to try to solve our problems. But they don't see the real problem. The problem is spiritual. Like it says in Chronicles, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. All right? Well, unless we can see that clearly, then everything we do is just insane, because it's only going to make matters worse, and that's where we're at today. And at verse 39, therefore the desert creatures will live there along with the jackals. The ostriches also will live in it, and it will never again be inhabited or dwelt in from generation to generation. Now see, this hasn't happened yet, right? But it did be reduced to that point where you had desert creatures that were living there along with the jackals. The ostriches will also live in it. All right, that's happened in the past, but this latter part of that verse 39, it has not happened yet. Look at it. And it will never be inhabited. Well, I just showed you that Babylon has always been inhabited, basically. And there's pictures right there to prove it, that people are still living there, right? So this hasn't been totally and completely fulfilled yet. It says, or dwelt in it from generation to generation. It hasn't happened yet. Verse 40. As when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah with its neighbors, declares the Lord, no man will live there, nor will any son of man reside there. Now, how did God overthrow Sodom and Gomorrah?
Fire.
With fire. And didn't I just read in chapter 18 that this is how God is going to overthrow Babylon when it comes back into prominence? You see what I'm saying? This has never had a fulfillment before, the way Jeremiah describes it. This is future date. And in verse 41 it says, "Behold, a people is coming from the north, and a great nation and many kings will be aroused from the remote parts of the earth. They seize their bow and javelin, and they are cruel and have no mercy. Their voice roars like the sea, and they ride on horses, marshaled like a man for battle against you, O daughter of Babylon." Now that verse 41 and 42, that's in the past. One that has a near fulfillment, we see it in the past, and the other one has a future fulfillment. You see, this is what these prophets do all the time. Same thing with like Jesus Christ. Sometimes it would talk about his first coming in one verse, and then talk about his second coming in another verse. You see what I'm saying? This is the way it always, the prophets always do this. In verse 43, "The king of Babylon has heard the report about them, and his hands hang limp. Distress has gripped him, agony like a woman in childbirth." Now, isn't that amazing? Isn't that just exactly what happened to Belshazzar? Exactly what happened to him. We read all about that in Daniel chapter 5. Remember when it's saying this? Let me just read it. In chapter 5 of Daniel, it said, "Then they brought the gold, the vessels, and that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine, and they praised the gods of gold and silver and of bronze and iron and wood and stone." Wasn't that just what we're reading there in chapter 18 of Revelation? "Suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together." Now look at over here. Look at this verse 43 of chapter 50 of Jeremiah. "The king of Babylon has heard the report about them, and his hands hang limp. Distress has gripped him, agony like a woman in childbirth." Now jump back over to Daniel chapter 5. Look at it. It says here in verse 6, "Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together." That's exactly what happened, right? And then he says here in that verse 44 of Jeremiah, just winding us down, "Behold, one will come up like a lion from the thicket of the Jordan to a perennially watered pasture. For in an instant I will make them run away from it, and whoever is chosen I will appoint over it. For who is like me, and who will summon me into court? And who then is the shepherd who can stand before me? Therefore hear the plan of the Lord, which he has planned against Babylon, and his purposes which he has proposed against the land of the Chaldeans. Surely they will drag them off, even the little ones of the flock. Surely he will make their pasture desolate because of them. At the shout, Babylon has been seized. The earth is shaken, and an outcry is heard among the nations." Now, look at that. It's right in here in that verse, these closing three verses, it's dealing with, it's already happened in the past when they were overthrown by Cyrus, but also it's tying it in with that last verse, verse 46, "At the shout, Babylon has been seized, the earth is shaken, and outcry is heard among the nations." Now, that applied when she was overthrown by the Medes and the Persians, but it's going to have its ultimate fulfillment when God has this city totally and completely destroyed. Remember I just read there in chapter 18 of Revelation where the merchants of the earth are going to weep and wail over her because of her destruction? This is really, really heavy, and I know we're out of time now, but like I'm saying, I'm really glad that they divided this up into two chapters, because there's 110 verses that deal with the Babylon's destruction, you know, her coming destruction that's been foretold. And I'm telling you, this is not applying to the Catholic Church, or this has not had its fulfillment totally, completely in the past. This is going to be future date. God has a special judgment for the religious horror that has led so many people astray with false teachings, with idolatry, with all kinds of things that just insult God, and that are referred to as quote-unquote spiritual. And on the other side of the coin, how many people do you think have been damned because of the love of money? I mean, Paul says that it's the root of all kinds of evil. And in a sense, when we put money before God, now we've connected with this economic whore. And the Bible refers to that as immorality against God. We are being unfaithful to God. We are being adulterous towards God. All right. So we really do need to take inventory and just ask ourselves, man, is money more important to me to God? And we just can't just simply assume that it's not. We have to really, I think, analyze whether it is or it isn't. because money has a subtlety to it. It has a tenacity to it that you won't believe. So we really have to take inventory and say, man, does God come before money? Because if money comes before God, then we are hooked up with this economic whore. And we really do need to repent of that. Anybody have anyone to add or share?
Yeah,